Well, Victor, this is an interesting experience, and I suppose a reasonable place to begin would be back at the beginning, and I think people would certainly be interested in how your career started and how you got into this field and what things were like in those bygone days.
Okay. Well, I got into the development of the nervous system through my doctor's thesis. But perhaps I have to give a little bit more background. I went to Freiburg in 1919 to study with Spemann, who was then considered to be one of the outstanding experimental embryologists, although he was not yet very widely known. And after a few semesters, I asked him for a thesis. At that time, there were no other formalities. You didn't have to complete any coursework or anything like that. You didn't have to take any prelims. You just asked for a thesis, and if the professor thought you were ready for it, he gave it to you. So that's happened. That's what happened. And at that time, he and half a dozen graduate students and postdocs worked on what later became known as the organizer. And since he had my academic future in mind, he thought I should have a completely independent topic for which I would get credit independently of the work on the upper lip of the blastopore. He put it this way, that there are already too many people hanging on the upper lip, and I should start somewhere else. So, apparently he couldn't think of much else, so he suggested that I repeat to a checkup on some rather improbable results, which somebody else by the name of Durkin, D-U-Umlaut, R-K-E-N, had obtained. He contended that if he extirpated the eyes of a frog embryo, then not only would the eye be missing, but the legs would also be malformed. And he showed pictures of that in his paper, and he developed a rather far-fetched hypothesis that the whole business was neurogenic. That means that the absence of the eye would interfere with the development of the midbrain, and the midbrain defect resulting from that would be felt all through the spinal cord, and eventually the nerves going from the spinal cord to the limbs would be abnormal, and as a result, the limbs. Well, so I did many hundreds of experiments, and at first, lo and behold, I did get some limb abnormalities in a very small percentage of cases following the eye extirpation. Turned out later that that was an accident, that it was probably due to some something that in the water in which I reared the animals, some trace elements of zinc or something else, had nothing to do with the nervous system and with the operation. And eventually then I went, after a few years, after I've done in about 1,000 or so eye extirpations, I just began to face the problem of whether the nervous system has any influence of limb development in a frontal attack. But that's another business. That's the way I got in.
So what came of the thesis then?
Well, I published a thesis in which I said that out of 1,000, I had only maybe 5 or 10% malformation. It was very unlikely. And I tested all possible explanations. For instance, that there would be races in Germany which would respond differently from each other. And I, And I explored that and found that whether they were from North Germany or South Germany behaved exactly the same way.
So feces weren't too much different then than now.
Yeah.
So who were some of the others in at that time in Spemann's lab?
Well, there was this first assistant and oldest student, Otto Mangold, who took his habilitation at that time, which means that he's here to present a paper and a lecture to be admitted to the faculty. That happened while I was there. He was very active. I don't think he was very original, but he was very much liked by Spemann and very much promoted by him. He became later his successor at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin as the director of the Institute for Experimental Embryology, and eventually he became the successor of Spemann when Spemann retired in 1939, I think. And there was another man whom Spemann instigated to do some experimental work on amphibians, but who was really a honeybee man, a man who was much more interested in honeybees and their culture and pollination and that kind of thing, and who eventually established a research institute for honeybee science and gave up experimental embryology altogether. There were some others who taught other things. At the very beginning, for the first year when I was there, there was a Swiss, Fritz Balzer, whom he had known in Würzburg at the laboratory of Boveri, where Spemann grew up. And Balzer was also a student of Boveri, and he had a very profound influence on me, and became later on, after he had moved after a year, to take over the directorship of the Zoological Institute in Bern, became a close friend of mine. And he continued a slightly different line of research, which dates back partly to the influence of Boveri. He combined genetics and experimental embryology in a very ingenious way. He had a lot of students, among them Ernst Haddon, whom you probably know, mm-hmm. who became very famous later on. So his work on Drosophila.
Well, what about Spemann himself? What kind of a person was he to work for?
Well, he was different persons, and I mean, he was very different at the time, to me at least, and to others. When I was a student, when I was a graduate student from 1919 to 24, 25, and then I went away and came back as an instructor at his institute at his invitation and became a staff member, went through habilitation, and then we became fairly close, and I got to know him very much better, and a friendship developed to the extent that the generation gap permitted that. He was always very friendly and helpful, although I must say that with his PhD students, he used the sink and swim method. And the only advice I got at one time, really during the 2 years that I worked on my thesis, the only advice I got was when I asked him whether a very particularly important embryo should be fixed or whether I should wait for a day or two, he said, "I am glad that I don't have to make that decision." So that was maybe an advice for the future to apply to my own students. But later on, he never interfered. I mean, he never gave much advice. He never told me what to do or what not to do. He in that respect, he was very reserved.
But, I mean, he did give you the thesis. You were assigned that project.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that. And later on, all my future work developed out of that beginning, or I developed it myself. And he took very little interest in it because his interest was very strongly focused on the very early development, and mine started when his interest ended.
And what was your perception of his important work as it was going on in the 20s?
I thought it was extremely important. It was, these were the years that led to the organizer experiment. So I lived through all the excitement that culminated in the experiment, which was actually completed, where the data were out in 1922, although it was published in 24 by Spemann and Tilde Mangold. So I lived through the excitement of these years, and was perhaps the most, except for the beginning of the NGF, it was by far the most exciting period, although I was a bystander.
And what was the relation between Spemann and Mangold? Was it her work?
Very close, very close. They worked very close together. They published together, they planned experiments together, and when Mangold moved to Berlin-Dahlem, Spemann kept very close track.
Was she a postdoctoral fellow, essentially?
No, Otto Mangold. When Otto Mangold became director, he kept very closely in touch with Spemann, and everything was planned together.
No, Hilde Mangold.
Hilde Mangold. Well, she was a graduate student who, at the last moment, after another topic failed to give results, got this assigned the experiment, which was later got to be known as the organizer.
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in bringing out. Whether her role in the organizer.
She was merely a graduate student who did what she was told, and she labored on it. And at the very end of the breeding season in 1921, I think it was, she got this famous embryo, which showed that if you transplant an upper lip to the flank of another embryo, you get a secondary embryo. Everybody got extremely excited, and then she was supposed to produce more. But it was so difficult to do these experiments, and since we didn't have any antibiotics, they died by the hundreds, literally. And out of a very substantial work of several hundred operations, five were published.
So all of that work is based on five embryos?
Yes. And of course, a few years later, when Holtvater developed the necessary techniques, you could raise these embryos by the dozens to much older stages. But the essential results and conclusions were drawn on these five embryos, and Spemann wrote the paper.
So Holtvater came into the lab somewhat?
He came simultaneously with me. We worked in the same room for several years, except that we had different working times. I worked during the day and he worked during the night. So we didn't see much of each other.
And what was the whole evolution of his work, and how was it received by Spemann?
Well, he got an even more remote doctor's thesis about the liver of the amphibian embryo, which amounted to absolutely nothing except that it earned him the PhD. And then he went traveling around the world and doing all kinds of things, being an artist, and very late, 3 or 4 years or 5 years later, he decided to go back to science. He was ready to teach. He was ready to take a job as an oyster supervisor of an oyster station on an island. And then when the position which I had with Mangold in Dahlem, Berlin-Dahlem, became vacant because I moved to back to Freiburg. He was offered that job, and that's the only reason why he stayed in science, that I moved away. So I made room for him, and the years which followed from 1929 to 33 were by far his most productive years. But then he got into trouble with Spemann because he made discoveries which...
Yes, I mean, I think people are curious about what that must have been like. I mean, after all, a discovery that more or less questioned the major work of the mentor.
Well, it was a very delicate situation because he worked in the laboratory of Spemann's closest collaborator and friend, and had hundreds of experiments which proved that the dead organizer can induce, if anything, better than the living one, and that was had not been agreed upon.
This it wasn't assigned.
hadn't been agreed upon between Mangold and Spemann, and Holtfreder never kept it secret, so it very filtered very soon through Mangold to Freiburg what happened. And then Spemann suddenly discovered that his favorite student Bartzmann had also had one or two embryos that had been exposed to some kind of a killed tissue and produced some neural enlargements, not real embryos. And another man had Spemann-Mangold. And somebody else had also had, Mangold had a very dubious case, and Bautzmann, who was, I think I mentioned mm-hmm. him, Bautzmann had this case, who was in Hamburg. So Holtfreder traveled to Bautzmann at Spemann's request, I think, to straighten out mm-hmm. these things and find out further and so on. And it turned out that Bautzmann had two or three cases and so on.
So he didn't fight this evidence?
He didn't fight it, but it was agreed. Mangold also had a dubious case. Neither Bautzmann nor Mangold published it because they didn't think they had much, quite correctly. So Spemann, in his best diplomatic way, arranged for a four-man report in Naturwissenschaften, which appeared in 1932, in which Bautzmann and Mangold reported their more than dubious cases. Spemann reported an equally dubious case which one of his students had had, and Holtfreder came out with his 150 or so cases. And Spemann wrote me, I just found a letter from Spemann recently, in which he wrote me in 32. Well, he was delighted that this potentially explosive issue had been settled in such an amiable way. That means Holtfreder had been beaten down to consent to have, instead of publishing what he had, to put his name on a four-man paper. So it wasn't quite above board.
So what was your impression of Spemann's more personal reaction to that? I mean, he must have been very...
He of course accommodated, as a scientist would do. I mean, you can't fight facts, particularly if they are so terribly impressive as the ones that Holtfreder had. So he made the best of it and pointed out that from the beginning he had neither had an organizer theory and always had insisted that the reacting system would be at least as important as the stimulus. So he made the best of it, and in his book which he wrote at that time, which appeared in 34, it was about the worst time to write a book about it, but he made the best of it.
Well, this is a very complicated issue that we've talked about before, but I mean, looking back on all of that sequence of events from the organizer experiment through the publication of this four-man paper. I mean, what do you regard as the upshot of all that? I guess the question I'm really asking is how should people regard Spemann's contribution in the light of the key experiment?
Well, I think the substance of the key experiment stands completely uncontested. The subsequent results made it extremely difficult to interpret it, but the time hasn't come yet to really tackle it. There has been an awful lot of efforts to identify and isolate a chemical substance which would do complicated things, and I think that has been done, although the biochemistry may not be the best, but the whole business, of course, has gotten lost because the phenomena which we are dealing with in the organizer experiment are supercellular events on a level of organization which at the moment is completely inaccessible to analysis. I mean, molecular biology, cellular biology, subcellular biology, and molecular biology has wiped this whole problem off the map.
For the time being, only one hopes.
Yes.
Well, let's come back a bit to the nervous system. I mean, this is all really embryology that we've been talking about. So what were the events that led you from embryology to neuroembryology?
Well, the point is that for about 20 or 25 years I was an embryologist who attended the meetings of the embryological societies and was a full-fledged member. I was even the president of the Society for Developmental Biology for several years, and I happened to work on the nervous system just as other people happen to work on the heart or you name it. And the emphasis on neuro really didn't come until Rita came in 49.
Well, maybe that gets ahead of the story. I mean, what happened, maybe it would be interesting to say a little bit about what happened in the 30s and how you came to leave Germany and how you came to
well,
university.
Okay, well, I mean, the only thing that made me different from most other embryologists is that I asked some very specific questions about the kind of interactions between embryonic structures which were generally considered as inductions, Lenz induction, ear induction, and so on. So the basic problem that was being discussed in the 20s and 30s was interactions between embryonic structures. And the obvious thing in the which characterizes and the nervous system, makes the nervous system unique, is that it's connected with target organs, and that you can ask the question, what does happen if you remove the target organ? What happens to the nerve centers? If you remove the nerve centers, what happens to the target organs? It was in the general framework of correlations in embryonic development, mm-hmm. applied specifically to the nervous system. So I had from the beginning these two questions. And the one question, what happens to the target if it doesn't become innervated, I had resolved already in 1928 by showing that if you let a limb of an amphibian grow without innervation, which has never seen a nerve, it will go normally, develop normally. So that aspect was already resolved, so what was left?
And that was really your first independent work as an instructor.
Yeah,
right?
Yes, and that was decisive. I mean, that was crucial, and there was never any doubt about it. Nobody has ever touched it again, except myself with the chick embryo. But what was left was the reverse. And that I started when I came to Chicago And that was an extremely fortunate coincidence, because when I had to leave Germany, well, I didn't have to leave. I mean, I left on a Rockefeller Fellowship in 1932 when the signs were on the wall, but no decision was made.
So your acceptance of that fellowship had really nothing to do with the situation. You would have come.
Come anyway, because Spemann had been in Woodsole in 41, yeah. In 31, had befriended Lilly and Conklin and all the others in Woodsole, came back, and when the Rockefeller representative came to Spemann to ask whether he had somebody to give a Rockefeller Fellowship for the United States, he suggested me, and at the same time his friend Lilly is the person to whom, with whom I should work. And that was extremely fortunate, because Lilly was the only laboratory in this country that worked on chick embryos, and in 1909, that means 25 years or 22 years before I came, he had a student who had tried to extirpate, to kill wing birds in the chick embryo to see how the nervous system was reacting. How Lilly ever got that idea, I don't know. And Miss Shorey, who did it, disappeared from the literature, so I couldn't ask her either. So Dr. Lilly and I just agreed to repeat that experiment in order to try out my glass needle technique. That was the assignment I had from Spemann and the Rockefeller Foundation, to apply the glass needle technique of Spemann to the chick embryo. So the obvious thing to do was to repeat the whole Shorey experiment.
Well, was Lilly just a sort of a bystander in that, or did he really have an active
interest? Oh, for heaven's sake. Lilly was one of the most important statesmen in Chicago. At Chicago University, he was dean of the medical biological faculty, and was sitting in the hospital in his office. And he was, I think, also president of the National Academy or Research Council. I don't know these details, but he was 100% busy, and the only time I ever saw him really was in Woodsole in summer. So I was entirely on my own. And I was turned over to Dr. Willier, who was the embryologist in the zoology department. And he had it as his right hand, the lady who got her PhD with him, Mary Rawls, who knew everything that anybody knew about handling chick embryos. So I was turned over to her, and I picked up from her what I could, and then a few months, in some respects, I was ahead of her.
And at what point did your conversion from the amphibian to the chick take place? I mean, did you already...
At the moment I entered Chicago.
But, I mean, you had no preconception that it would be nice to move on to the chick.
No,
this
no.
was just happened.
It was a 1 year proposition.
So then what events led to your not returning and to coming to St. Louis?
Well, after I had been in Chicago for 5 months or 4 months, Hitler came to power, and Spemann wrote me a letter that I couldn't come back. He couldn't do anything about it. He had orders from above not to appoint anybody or to dismiss anybody who had any Jewish racial Jewish history. The fact that I was a Protestant didn't count. My parents were racially Jewish, and that was it. And so I had to, unfortunately, the Rockefeller Foundation immediately started an emergency support program, relief program, for displaced scholars, as they called it. And I was on top of their list because I was already a fellow. And they supported me for three years until I came to St. Louis.
So, I mean, Spemann's behavior in all this was... how would you characterize it?
Well, I mean, he had no choice. Mm-hmm. What his feelings were, I don't know. I have quite a few letters from that time. He regretted to lose me and so on and so forth. At that time, I think he still had hopes that Hitler would save the German people from their terrible economic and political doldrums in which they had fallen, but so he did never mention anything political in his letters. But he certainly expressed his personal feelings.
Mm-hmm. So from the personal point of view, he was well-meaning, but politically perhaps naive.
Well, I mean, I think nobody could have done anything different.
And then
I mean, he couldn't have fought it, yeah. You know, even if he had wanted to. I mean, in that respect, in other respects, he might have shown more resistance, but as far as the relation to me was concerned, it was absolutely correct, and nothing else could have been done.
And then from Chicago to St. Louis, how did that come about?
Well, I mean, there was a... They needed a biologist, and they had some very shrewd people, and, I mean, we refugees were available for bargain, and I made such a bargain. And he came, and a very shrewd and very pleasant dean who had plenty of time because he was a professor of Latin, came and looked me over, and I came in April, I think April 34, I came for a meeting to St. Louis and was looked over by other people, including Corey and others, and then I was offered the job. And I moved in 35. I think I came,
And, I mean, did you have in mind coming here, setting out on a new line of work, or, I mean, what was your...
Well, my assignment was to establish a strong program in experimental embryology. At that time, Frank Schmidt was the major operator in the department. He was not yet chairman, but he became chairman while I was here, and we cooperated very strongly. I mean, he became extremely interested in embryology, and I picked up some bits and pieces of what at that time was the forerunner of molecular biology. He was really one of the pioneers, and he worked, he had somebody who worked on X-ray diffraction of nerve membranes.
I think it's worth emphasizing. It's just not appreciated that he was really a remarkable.
He was an at that time. He was truly productive and creative and forward-looking, and he was certainly one of the most forceful pioneers, forerunners of molecular biology, no doubt. In fact, we published a paper together.
So what were the experiments then of those days when you first came here in the mid-30s?
Well, I developed, published a lot of material which I had accumulated in Chicago, particularly transplantation. I mean, the new thing was transplantation. I mean, the real thing that I claim credit for is to have made the chick embryo available for very complex and a great variety of experiments which were formerly not possible, because the technique of using glass needles wasn't applied. And I exploited everything that could be done with respect to limb transplantation, particularly the problem of whether again, nerves were necessary. Then the effect of limb extirpation on sensory ganglia and motor system, and the a problem which I had become very much interested with amphibians already in the early days was how nerves find their way to their targets. And then I became interested in the early phases of motor column differentiation, mitotic patterns. I discovered that the ventral part was ahead of the dorsal part and so on. And then in 1947, Rita came. So in these years between 1932 when I came and 1947, I think there were only a handful of people who worked on the nervous system. They were all embryologists who happened to work on the nervous system. I was practically alone. There was Detweiler was the only big figure who at that time worked, and he helped me a great deal. He promoted me very much. He invited me to one of the first symposia. At that time, symposia were invented. Believe it or not, when I came, there weren't symposia. There was the Gross Society, I think, was one of the first two or three societies that invented symposia, and Paul Weiss was very instrumental in that. So Detweiler invited me to a symposium in Cincinnati. I remember that quite vividly, and promoted me very much, and so I got grants from the Rockefeller Foundation and so on.
And the way in which Rita came, I think, is known to a lot of people, but maybe worth discussing.
Well, I mean, she read a paper which I had published. She read the first paper I wrote in Chicago, which was published in 1934, on the effect of wing extirpation on the motor system. And she read it during the war, I think in 1940, 41, 42, and under very difficult conditions, she repeated the experiment together with her teacher, preceptor, mentor, Giuseppe Levi. There are several papers of Levi and Levi Montalcini on the effects of wing extirpation on the sensory ganglia. And she came to entirely different interpretations of the results, which were identical. And since I never have indulged in controversies in public or in print, I thought to settle that by repeating the experiments together and see what we got. So I invited her to come to St. Louis.
And how did that turn out? I mean,
it turned out that she was right, as usual.
Yeah.
In her interpretation. But then we became interested in going on from there.
Yes. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, how did that whole business start of your mutual control business?
Well, I mean, when we planned the program, it wasn't just repeating the wing extirpations, but we wanted to really do a very comprehensive job, so at the same time we planned to do wing extirpations and additional transplantation of additional wings. What? I hope nothing. Okay. So, as you know, the wing extirpations gave some fringe benefits, namely the discovery of naturally occurring neuronal death. But you don't want to talk about this unless you want to.
Yes, of course, but let's let it...
Okay, that was the one. First of all, we showed that indeed the spinal ganglia became smaller when the wing was missing. And her idea that this was due to a secondary degeneration of cells which had already differentiated in the abs- or without influence of the limb was correct. Mm-hmm. That means it was a regressive process rather than a progressive inhibition of a progressive process, as I had mm-hmm. guessed wrongly.
Yes.
And then she discovered the naturally occurring death in spinal ganglia which had not been affected by the operation, which were on the same series of slides. So she went down the slides and found that these degenerating cells, which were very prominent in the wing innervating ganglia, were also present in the thoracic ganglia.
Yeah, it's amazing this was missed, since so many people must have looked over the years at that.
Yeah, well, you would be amazed how difficult it is to really see things when you look at things. Mm. I mean, for instance, since the beginning of the 19th century, people have looked at spinal cords. And I was the first one to really see that at a certain moment all the mitoses are almost exclusively concentrated in the ventral half, and 2 days later they are all concentrated on the dorsal half and there's nothing on the ventral. Hundreds of people have looked at that, because that was the object of all embryology courses all over the world. So every instructor who taught students to look at the spinal cord of chick embryos or pig embryos mm-hmm. looked at it but didn't see it. No, it's very difficult to. So she had an eye on it, and I mean, this is one of the characteristics of Rita's genius, really. To see things which 9 out of 10 others would have not noticed. And then very soon we became much more interested in the hyperplasia, so-called, of the ganglia, which had to innervate two wings instead of one. So we are peripherally overloaded, as Detweiler called it. So we concentrated all our, that was for us much more miraculous than death. I mean, growth is more interesting than death. So the discovery of naturally occurring death was really became dormant for 10 years until some people, amphibian people, picked it up.
But
we went ahead with the investigation of why or in which way do ganglia become larger.
Yeah, but I mean, you were aware that the naturally occurring death was a critical discovery, or was that?
No, it wasn't. We weren't.
So that came only later in.
Yeah, other people made a big. I mean, this became a media event much later.
Yeah. So, but I mean, things can become media events much later and still be recognized as important events by the discoverers at the time.
Well, quite frankly, I must say, at that time, I wrote the paper, and I know that I went into a great analysis proposed a hypothesis of competition and so on, but didn't follow up. I mean, I was fully aware of what it was, but the interest in the enlargement of ganglia was so much greater, mm-hmm. fortunately.
Yeah, sure. That paid off handsomely.
Paid off better. Paid off earlier.
Yeah. So, how then did those events unfold, leading from the interest in hyperplasia to Bucher's experiments?
Well, of course, at that time, everybody began to think in chemical terms. So there must be a chemical trophic factor in the wing that nourishes the ganglia and prevents them from dying. That much was clear. So the obvious next thing was to see whether there couldn't be a way of identifying the chemical agent. And we knew that we couldn't get anywhere. First of all, we didn't have a biochemist at that time. Second, we knew enough to know that you couldn't get by any chance enough material out of even 100 or 1,000 winged birds. So we started to implant liver and all kinds of other materials into the coelomic cavity to get bulk, you know, eventually. If liver worked, then we could extract something out of a big liver.
Mm-hmm. I see, so you were just implanting various things in the hopes of finding a large
tissue that would stimulate the
hyperplasia.
Correct. And that didn't work. And then I showed Rita the paper of Bücker, who had 2 years earlier gotten this very interesting idea of transplanting a mouse tumor into the coelomic cavity for the same reason. And he had gotten a slight hyperplasia, but not anything much better than what the limb would do. And to his eternal regret, he moved to something else, and when we asked him whether it was all right to repeat that experiment, he said yes.
Was he still in your lab?
No. He had been away. He was an older person who was a high school teacher in New City High School and had published already on Colimbola. You know what Colimbola are? These are primitive insects. So he was a specialist on primitive insects when he started, and all he wanted was a PhD. He was a very ambitious person and a very stubborn person. And he came to me and said, I want a PhD. I can work only on weekends and in the summer. And I said to him, I don't know anything about insects. If you want to get a PhD, you have to work on the chick embryo. So he worked on the chick embryo and wrote his PhD thesis, a very nice piece of work. But not dealing with sarcoma. It was not my idea. It was his idea. So that was a follow-up of his PhD thesis when he was already in Washington, D.C.
I see. I didn't know this. So when you say it was his idea, I mean it was his idea in the sense that he used sarcoma, but I mean he was following the general plan of seeking the bulky tissue
Exactly, yes. And I do not know. Whether this idea came about in discussions with me about, it would have been very obvious to discuss this topic, just I discussed it with Rita.
Sure.
But he had the idea, and nobody has contested that. He had the idea to do it, he did it, he described the results.
And he did this in Washington?
I don't know where he did it. He was first in Columbia, Missouri, and then he moved to Virginia or Washington, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But he did not do it here,
and I didn't know about it. Well, I don't know whether I knew about it before, but I mean, I just had the reprint.
Yes.
Rita had the reprint, and we decided to, since we were unsuccessful with our efforts, and then Rita got the mouse sarcoma at 80. In 1937 from Bar Harbor, I think.
Which were exactly the ones that he had used.
Yes. And he had already found, he did find either at that time or later, that carcinomas don't work. So we used the one that he considered, we had three, sarcoma 1, 37, 180, and settled on 180. The earlier works were done with both. 37 and 80, there was no difference. But we got the same results except on a much larger scale. The results were much more spectacular. And Rita very soon had the idea of improving the technique by transferring the sarcoma in the chorioallantoic membrane of the chick embryo for several transfers, just keep several passages to get the tumor adjusted to the chick.
Whatever that means.
whatever that means, but it worked, because, or we got very powerful, much more powerful sarcomas than Buch ever had.
You didn't do anything really different.
We didn't. Well, that was different. She didn't take it out of the mouth into the cheek, but passaged it through several weeks.
And the nervous systems in successive chicks were progressively more affected by the...
No, I can't. There was no... there was no... great...
chain of... But in any event...
At any rate, that's what the standard technique that we used, and very soon she found, the first look at one of the most dramatic embryos was that the sympathetic chain ganglia were, if anything, even more enlarged. So much so that the chain practically was transformed into a rope.
Yes, this is amazing. I mean, that such a strong effect was seen with this.
Yes, and to this day, our contention at that time that part of that story is an increase in cell number is not yet settled. Mm-hmm. It could all be just enlargement. Mm-hmm. And then this thing unrolled by itself. And then we very soon... Then an interesting thing came. After we had the bulk, we needed a biochemist. Mm-hmm. So we talked to Sid Velik, who was the professor of biochemistry in Corey's department here, who was the protein chemist. And we invited him and showed him the preparations and asked him whether he would cooperate with us. He looked at that and thought for a day, and then he said, no, that's hopeless. He wouldn't touch it. Well, then we were looking for somebody else. And then there was Martin Kamen, happened to be here. I don't know with whom he worked. You know Kamen. Mm-hmm. And he was a great friend of Rita and me too. And he belonged to the Kornberg Malcone group. I mean, that was all one big group of friends. Hoeknes, Kornberg, so on. And he said he had a postdoc who didn't have a job, who would perhaps be interested, and that was Stanley Cohen.
And this was in 55 or so then?
No, it wasn't 53 perhaps. So Stanley Cohen came over and he took the job, and within a few months he had a nucleoprotein which worked extracted from the mouse sarcoma, that it worked. But he didn't know whether it was the nucleic acid or the protein, so he asked Kornberg what to do. And Kornberg said use phosphodiesterases, which you get out of snake venom. So we ordered snake venom. Then he found that increased the effect by very considerably, enormously. And then, unfortunately, he made the control experiment and injected pure snake venom. And then it went up 1,000-fold compared to the purest extract he had from the mouse sarcoma.
Now, how was he working in those days doing those experiments? Was that done by himself more or less?
Yes.
Directly
yes.
With Rita? And
no. He had his own biochemical little outfit. I know nothing about it. Mm-hmm. See that the Cephadex column. And I mean, whatever one did at that time. I didn't have the remotest idea. Didn't even become interested in it. To this day, I mean, I have stayed away from test tubes and
supervise.
And then, of course, Rita and T got more and more involved in developing one problem after another, and then he had the brilliant idea of A, using the anti-serum to prove the proteinic nature of his agent, and got the sympathectomy, immunosympathetic too. And the other brilliant idea was to, since we worked on a very low budget, to reduce the expense of snakes venom by using the salivary glands of male mice, which were cheaper than snakes and cheaper than female mice.
So that was the motive for looking at the mouse, was just economics.
Well, yes. Was also, I mean, it was obvious that it would be much simpler to use mice because it came from salivary glands. I mean, that was his idea.
Yeah.
And then we used male mice because female mice, as you know, are more expensive.
I didn't know that. But
sure, I mean, they reproduce. I mean, pregnant male. You can buy pregnant male mice, which are more expensive than non-pregnant males.
Very expensive.
Well, it was all matters of dollars, but at that time, we didn't operate on $100,000 budgets. So, and he was lucky enough to get male adult mice because neither young male mice nor female mice have the NGF in any appreciable amount.
Or rats.
Very little. So if he had settled on rats, it wouldn't have helped very much. So he hit by serendipity exactly the right material. And as you know, to this day, the male adult mouse salivary gland is the bulk.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think one thing I've always been curious about is why in this period when NGF was taking off in many respects, your involvement in it decreased rather than increased.
Well, I mean, to be quite honest, first of all, I could not participate in the biochemical turn it took. And second, I wanted to give Rita the credit. I mean, I was quite well known at that time. Rita was a completely unknown. On the other hand, I recognized fully that her tremendous share in the whole sequence of discoveries, and I felt that she should get the full credit for what she was worth. So I wouldn't want to stand in her way, but also I was less and less interested and involved in the biochemical trend that it necessarily, I mean, inevitably took. And I wanted to do, I mean, I've never done anything that I wasn't interested in. So I wanted to do something else which interested me. And then I got involved with the motility. Opens a new chapter in that.
Yes, we'll say a little bit about the motility, because I think of the various things that you've done, that's probably the least well known and appreciated.
Yeah, well, I regret that because I think that's the one in which I would claim the most originality in the exploration of an entirely new chapter.
Well,
I mean, I wasn't successful in putting it on the map, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have a fundamental intrinsic importance.
Well, amplify on that. I mean, why
well,
do you think that?
I mean, the question of how animal behavior develops, of course, has been always on the minds of people. And as anybody who has come in contact with psychologists knows, they operate very differently from other scientists, namely from premises, from theories, from speculations, from hypotheses, from preconceived ideas. And the preconceived ideas, which then later on, of course, were experimentally proven, quotation marks, were the one that there's a tabula rasa at birth, that neither nerve connections nor synapses nor anything is organized. Everything becomes organized by experience, by learning, and so on. It was the one extreme. And the other one extreme was that experience and learning has nothing to do with the early phases of neurogenesis, that the right connections are made in forward reference to function and so on. So I thought that was an extremely important decision to be made experimentally. And since I was not a psychologist, I could be completely unprejudiced and tackle it with my methods of experimentation. I could make embryos with no sensory input.
Well, you were talking about motility before the tape was turned.
Well, there were not only these two polar differences in approach, in the theory of how behavior originates, but there was also a very influential and extremely interesting person by the name of Carghill, E.G. Carghill, whom I had the good fortune to meet in Woods Hole in the 30s, and from whom, incidentally, I inherited an extremely good technician, who took an intermediate position, but who had another very interesting prejudice or idea, which was very well founded on his observations on the salamander and blisterman, namely that all behavior from beginning to end is integrated. From the first swimming movements to food intake and so on. Swimming, walking, food intake, and was all integrated, and that local reflexes developed secondarily by what he called individuation, segregation from the total pattern. So for many years he dominated the field, and everybody, including people who worked on human fetuses, tried to replicate the total pattern. So I had to. When I started, I was fully aware that there were three possible solutions to the problem. Three prevailing but entirely different and mutually exclusive ways of looking at it. And I thought, to me, it was an interesting problem, how behavior develops. And I had all the tools and started on the chick embryo, and the first thing I did was to look what actually happens, which apparently nobody had done, because as I said before, first of all, the chick embryo was not particularly exciting, and second, they had preconceived ideas, so why would anybody look at what really happens if they knew already the outcome? Well, it's not quite fair, because people made observations, and the mammalian people were quite sure that Cockhill was wrong and that the local reflexes came first and so on and so forth. But there was a chaotic situation and a complete conflict of everybody against everybody else. And as a matter of fact, when I took it up in the 50s, it had been dormant for 10 or 15 years, nobody touched it because there was an impasse. So what I did was first to look at what the embryo actually did from the first beginning to the end. I looked at it as an embryologist. And I hired a man who came from psychology because I wanted to be absolutely sure if I'd work on behavior that I don't fall into any trap and that I have some competent person who has studied behavior. And he also knew statistics, which I'm very weak. And I knew that probably statistics would help. So I engaged a man by the name of Martin Balaban, who came with his family, and we worked for 2 years together. And the first thing I saw was, A, that there's nothing of the Coghill kind of integration, except in the first day or two, or the first day of movement. It was completely uncoordinated behavior where any part of the body could move while any other part either moved also or was not moving. And the second thing we observed immediately was the periodicity, that the embryo was constantly in motion for a minute or two and then suddenly became completely inactive and then took up again. And the third thing we observed was the rediscovery of something that had been observed in 1885 by a very outstanding German scientist, psychologist, and physiologist, William Pryor, who in 1885 had published the first book on the physiology of the embryo, which you find an absolutely unparalleled collection of data on everything that concerns embryos, pig embryos, human embryos, and so on. He also later on published a book on the behavior development of his son from the day of birth, which later on was repeated in Hamburg and led to Piaget. So he was the precursor of me and of Piaget. And he had observed that in the first 3 days of movements of the chick embryo, they start at incubation day 3.5. So from 3.5 to 7.5 days of incubation, you find this kind of movements, spontaneous, we called it, he'd called it a little bit differently, but I mean I called it spontaneous motility, was independent of sensory input. No matter of no amount of scratching or tickling or stimulating would produce any movement during an inactivity phase. So he had discovered a pre-reflexogenic period in the chick embryo lasting for 3 days. And that was the third thing that we did and repeated and found very convincing. So we knew that the people were wrong who preached integration, total integration from beginning and end. We knew that the people were wrong who attributed all beginning of behavior to sensory input. And we had established what Pryor knew, that the central nervous system in an early embryo can generate motility action potentials independently of any sensory input. And we stressed very much the periodicity, which however gets lost at 13, 14 days. The embryo becomes so active that it almost continuously moves. But up to 13 days there's this periodicity. We stressed that. We stressed the lack of coordination of parts and the spontaneous motility. And to this day I believe that the complete neglect of neurophysiologists of spontaneous motility, except in REM sleep, is completely neglected. It may have something to do with the spontaneous activity in REM sleep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the obvious, crucial, and crowning experiment, of course, was to deafferent the whole leg from beginning to end, and to show that spontaneous, that motility in the embryo is not only self-generated, or whatever you call it, spontaneous between days 3 and 4.5 and 7.5, but throughout the whole period until hatching comes, where integration is needed. So Eleanor Wenger did this very complicated and very difficult experiment of completely deafferenting the leg region of the spinal cord by making a cut and or a gap in the anterior spinal cord so that no input can come in from rostral, from the brain, and cutting off the spinal ganglia. And these preparations, which were very difficult to get, were then observed by Ron Oppenheim and me under the mic, under the binocular scope, and we found that the motility was exactly the same as in embryos which had only the dorsal gap. The dorsal gap reduces total motility, but it was very clear that up to the point when the hatching movements begin, all motility is of the type described, self-generated. And then the only thing that was to be done after that, I mean, then came the anticlimax. I mean, that then I couldn't go any further because I wasn't an electrophysiologist. And the people who worked with me, Provine and Oppenheim, didn't follow up. Provine did for a year or two, but gave up. Oppenheim turned back to neuronal death and all that kind of stuff. Didn't develop a electrophysiological seminar. So the only thing, the only interesting thing we did, I did with Oppenheim, was to study hatching. That hadn't been done by anybody since Reaumur, 1767 or 85. Nobody knew how a bird gets out of the egg.
Seems amazing.
Yeah, particularly since there are so many poultry
science
departments. And we did a very thorough job, spent a year and a half on that together, sitting there really for many hours just looking at what happened, worked that out. And I think that's a very good and very coherent story, and it shows that the embryo switches fairly suddenly from the uncoordinated movements which I described before to a highly complicated, highly integrated set of movements that leads to hatching. There's no transition. It's not so that this is gradually built up, but that comes triggered by hormonal or some other physiological conditions. Suddenly another, or I shouldn't pump that, suddenly another type of movement comes into effect. And the last thing I want to say is that Well, we, quite correctly, I think, stressed very strongly the lack of integration between the different parts of the body during activity phases. For instance, the eye can blink and the left leg can move and the two wings can be completely quiet, or one wing may just do a tiny movement in one joint and the leg may very heavily be activated in all its joints. So it was a complete lack of coordination. And then one of our PhD students and Bakoff discovered that at 7.5 days, that means at the moment when sensory input comes in, the synergistic and antagonistic muscles within a leg are already integrated. So what we emphasized was the integration of different parts of the body, and what she showed is that does not mean that the entire program for antagonistic and synergistic movement in the leg is already prepared before sensory input takes over. So, I mean, I regret very much that this whole 10 or 12 years of what I thought was original and important has come into complete and total oblivion.
Well, that's, you know, that'll change. I mean, the history of all the things you've talked about have had periods of dormant periods, as you've referred to it, and I think this one may...
Well, I'm sorry that I won't live to see it revived.
Well, you never know. I think at the end, maybe it's worth asking an obvious question, but one that's nonetheless interesting, which is what, in looking back over what we've been talking about, you regard as the most important of these contributions?
Well, I mean, objectively, seen from the outside, it's obviously the nerve growth factor. I mean, it's undoubtedly...
Yes, but I mean, I guess one shouldn't be too influenced by fashion. I mean, what do you think?
The most important thing, I think, was to have kept this whole area of trophic interactions alive. I mean, put it on the map. And provided the necessary tools to do the microsurgery that's necessary to analyze these things. I mean, I would take credit for making it possible to operate on embryos, on chick embryos, mm-hmm. the way people did for 30 years exclusively on amphibians. Mm-hmm. And for the nervous system, certainly the chick embryo is more favorable because everybody knows, and it has been shown over and over again, that the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system of the chick embryo is much more clear-cut, more highly developed, and much more, you can be much more precise in asking questions and getting experimental designs than in amphibians.
Yes.
And I would add that if people have started the retinotectal business on the chick embryo, an awful lot of confusion could have been avoided. Schluss.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
An hour and a half.